Well, good morning. It's my real pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Abbas Barzagar, who is now assistant professor at Georgia State. I first met him when he was in the Graduate Division of Religion program in what is called the WASAR course of study, West and South Asian Religions. It was the new initiative, really, by the Graduate Division of Religion at Emory University to significantly develop additional religions, graduate work in religion beyond Christianity. So it brings together people in Islamic studies, Hindu studies, now Buddhist studies, and Jewish studies. And what it means is that the graduate population is has a significant number now of students who are Muslim, Jewish, and Hindu, and I don't know if we have a Buddhist student.
I'm sure we do.
We probably do.
Yeah,
right
I think
now.
We do.
Yeah, because of course the Dalai Lama is a distinguished professor at Emory University. But
is he technically in our department? Is that?
he's technically over everything.
Okay. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
But I had known Abbas for a number of months or a couple years or so, and then he came to me and asked if he could be an assistant in my New Testament in its context course, and I was just absolutely thrilled. And those of you who heard last week, I mentioned how he then came in and wrote the quizzes for the students, and the students just absolutely learned to love him and appreciate him as I myself. You know. And so we're so happy to have you here.
Thank you,
Abbas. Now, next Sunday, through God's good working, why Sarah Moahida will be with you while I'm gone to California, and she is from Indonesia now, and so she can talk to you about living as a Muslim woman in the world today, and she's plans to bring a DVD on education there. So we welcome you, Abbas, and please, he's really become very much of a specialist and a spokesperson for varieties of Muslims in the United States. And you work especially closely with this center of, what is this?
This Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. And it's basically a think tank, originally developed in Michigan, specializing on sort of Muslim American affairs, but really trying to develop policy studies and briefs for, you know, for folks in government and business and whatnot. And so this project has now expanded, and we have a center in D.C. as well. So anytime you hear a Pew research study or a report about sort of Muslim attitudes in the world or anything like that, it's our organization that does sort of the background work on that to prep Pew in order to ask the questions that it does. We conduct their focus groups and whatnot. Excuse me. And so we did one of the focus groups for one of their major studies out of Emory back in 2006 or 2007, right before they launched a big study. So I work with that organization. I took up this thirst I had to start writing op-ed and commentary articles back in around 2009, 2010. And so I started doing that. I'm doing that a little bit less so now. It's quite a fast-paced sort of the blogosphere with the Twitter and all these kind of things. It's very hard for me to keep up. And so I kind of got it out of my system, and now I just write a few pieces every year. Just to, you know, you kind of, I think it's graduate school, you kind of have a lot of goals, you know what I mean, and you got to get it out of your system. So I've got that out of my system now, and I'm trying to step back a little bit. But you know, the real reason I do a lot of that work is because living as a Muslim today, or knowing anything about Islam today, you have to be able to answer a variety of questions to a variety of different audiences. And my dissertation was actually about sort of 9th and 10th century Baghdad and relationships between Sunnis and Shiites and sort of the emergence of an Islamic empire in the midst of the classic or late antique world. And so really my main line of research is far removed from contemporary politics, far removed from the American context, but just by virtue of living in this world and sort of knowing a thing or two about this religion, I've tried to make myself available to a wider audience, and so I was eager to come to this program this morning, so thank you very much for having me. And I understand that this morning is a little bit more informal than what we might do this summer. And I know that Vernon asked me to speak a little bit about my own background and my own personal experiences growing up in the United States and whatnot. But before I do that, I'd like to preface sort of the conversation this morning, and I think I'll go to just to about 10:25 or 10:30 so that we have ample time for questions. But basically, before I get to my life story, which is quite idiosyncratic for a Muslim American, I come from a Iranian and Latino background. You know, my parents met in Orange County, California, and so I was not raised as a Muslim, but started practicing in college, and so I have a number. You know, I don't fit the bill as well as, for example, Sarah will next week, or a number of other speakers will that you might meet. However, my experiences do allow me insight into a number of different experiences for Muslims in America today. And I've written quite a bit on Muslims in America. And it's my dream, actually, to write a little bit about... I'd like to write a novel, or not either a novel or a sort of a really nice ethnography about the Muslim world through Atlanta. Because being here since 2004, I've come to realize that virtually every tradition of Islam, every sect, every subgroup, every kind of orientation can be found within about 15 mile radius of where we are right now. It's really quite an impressive thing, and it's really a phenomenon that only happens in the United States, in metropolitan centers, about 4 to 5 million and over. But I can tell you, subgroup after subgroup, I run into Chinese Muslims here, and so it's really an amazing thing. And so I want to be able to give you my personal experience, but I want to do that after I kind of preface a little bit about sort of Muslims around you in Atlanta today, and hopefully that can kind of give you a sense of what's happening in the world. So being in Atlanta, we're not far from some of the most influential African-American leaders in this country's history, right? Well, so much of African-American history was informed in the civil rights movement by the presence of African-American Muslim converts, first in the Nation of Islam, and then we have Malcolm X, and then we have really the conversion of the Nation of Islam towards a mainline Sunni community, and then we have a kind of splintering of that movement into a number of different groups. And so even here in Atlanta, we have centers where Farrakhan is still very active and alive, and then we have people who contested Farrakhan's succession to the Nation of Islam, and then we have Elijah Muhammad's son who took over the community down in East Atlanta. And that experience has really been one, as diverse as it is, in orientation, in ideology, and socioeconomic background, as diverse as it is, the African American Muslim experience, really since the early 20th century, has been about finding an authentic and autonomous, independent sort of religious and social mode for the failures of, after the failures of Reconstruction. And so basically, the movements really began in the northern industrial cities, out of Detroit, out of New York, in Ohio, in Michigan. And you find a number of African-American Muslim leaders in a very sort of idiosyncratic form, drawing upon ideas of Islam, Pan-Africanism, and forming new religious movements. Sometimes these were very, very far removed and alien to anything that we would know about Islam. For example, Marcus Garvey, the famous African-American leader who created the Black Star Line and a fleet of boats and wanted to ship African-Americans all the way back to Africa and kind of, establish a state back there. He was not necessarily a practicing Muslim. However, he drew upon sort of images of Timbuktu and the great sort of contributions that Muslims gave to African history as part of African-American idea. The Moorish Temple scientists did the same thing, and we still have a small group active in the west end of the Moorish Temple scientists, which is really a group that you can barely put on the chart as far as what its relationship to Islam might be. However, they had a book called the Quran. Has nothing to do with the Quran that we know. and if you look at it, there's virtually no reference to Muhammad, but there's the name Allah, and there's the word Quran. And the people in the organization used to dress up in Muslim garb from different parts of the Muslim world. And so, slowly, at the beginning of the 20th century, images of Islam and symbols of Islam started creeping into African-American culture. And it did so at the point where African-American culture was trying to protest the situation of African-American impoverishment, of illiteracy, of lack of education, lack of health care. And if you look at this Circle 7 Quran, for example, of the Moorish Temple scientists, and I bring them up knowing that they're an absolutely marginal group, but I bring them up to show you a sort of a larger point. If you read the Circle 7 Quran, about the first 20 chapters, and I do this with my students, I just show them the table of contents. First 20 chapters are really out there. You're talking about, you know, lost tribes of Israel. You're talking about Hindu stuff. Just this absolute, you know, jambalaya, really, of world religion. And then around chapter 20, 21, 22, we start getting messages of the black man's responsibility to his family, to God, how to raise your children, how to eat properly. Right. And you find that the focus of the practiced religion, not necessarily the philosophy or the ideology, the focus of the practiced religion was to not rehabilitate, but to habilitate, as one Muslim leader had put it. Because this was a community that had no way of being in the world. And so they were actually socializing from scratch. And so this was the focus of all of these different groups. And they basically gained momentum in organizations like the Nation of Islam. And we all remember the Nation of Islam for many of the sort of the vitriolic statements that its leader Elijah Muhammad would make about white folks, and categorical sort of denunciation of the white race and these sort of things. But even Elijah Muhammad himself was conscious that he was grooming a movement for autonomy, for empowerment, for self-betterment. And quickly, when his son took over, quickly his son did a complete 180 of the entire organization. Brought the organization absolutely in line with what would be called mainstream Sunni Islam. And today, that is sort of the most established community of African-American Muslims in the United States today. And the premier community of that nationwide network is actually here in Atlanta, off of Glenwood Avenue and 20. If you just go in, sort of take a left if you're going east off of Glenwood, you go in about a mile. They have a K-12 school. They have a nice gymnasium. They have a nice set of sports teams and mascots and sort of Muslim versions of cheerleaders. But you know, this is a community that is now producing its sometimes fourth generation of African Americans involved in Islam in one way or another, you know, with a kind of a Muslim background. And it's really quite impressive. You know, the women's basketball team, the high school basketball team, makes it regular to the state championships. Not the championships, but the championship tournament. But they wear the headscarves and long sweatpants. ESPN and HBO have done sort of specials on the community. It's a very vibrant and interesting community. It's in a rough part of town. However, there's a nice little oasis there. And they follow many of the same ideas and principles aimed at African-American social empowerment as did their sort of ancestors in the early 20th century. They have entrepreneurial networks. They have counseling services for family. They have sort of, before folks get married, they have sort of marriage training workshops. They have continuing education. Right now, today, my friends are teaching there for adult education, children's education. It's really one of the most established communities in the United States. And it's amazing to see how that community has come from its own past. You know, just maybe 40, 50 years ago, some of the members were involved in Elijah Muhammad's movement and part of that sort of very anti-progressive sort of message of Islam. And then we have other segments of the African-American Muslim community who also have departed quite a ways. And I'd say that 90% of the African-American Muslim community today is no longer affiliated with the Nation of Islam or any of those sort of movements. But they still hold a for a very sort of hard left position towards American social policy and American society. They really occupy a space that tries to again empower African Americans and, you know, educate, but it does so in a way that's very sort of Amy Goodman, Free Speech TV activist, you know, very much involved in sort of denouncing American, you know, American trespasses on foreign policy and domestic policy, calls attention to sort of FBI counter-surveillance programs and things like that. It's a pretty tough line, and we have a large network of African-American Muslim communities like that around the country, and of course, probably the nationwide exemplar of that movement was Imam Jamil at the West End Center. If anybody remembers, back in like 2002, he got arrested. Does anybody remember that? That was, you know, and he was formerly H-Rap Brown, sort of friends with Stokely Carmichael and all those guys, you know. So that's emblematic of that community. And literally, if you just drive down Highway 20, Interstate 20 here, you'll run into all of these different kinds of African-American communities. But the underlying principle is really still the same, aimed at social empowerment. And that's really what the African-American Muslim experience has been about. And I can confidently say that, you know, the group down in East Atlanta that I was just mentioning, the Atlanta Masjid of Al-Islam, whose leader for so many years you may have known, Imam Pleeman Al-Amin, he's sort of a figure in the city.
Real tall guy?
No. Mansour Sabri is pretty tall, who's the current leader, younger fellow like me, he's a good friend of mine. So, you know, I can confidently say that they have moved well past sort of a racial orientation towards their religiosity, and really moved towards what I would call, and what I do regularly call, sort of an Abrahamic Americanism. And the idea is that we have a Judeo-Christian sort of grand narrative to our country's identity, and many Muslim communities in the United States are trying to tap into that through an Abrahamic link, and really believe that much of what is at the heart of this nation's project in the Constitution, in its social history, and its constant progression towards a realization of the dream of the founders, if you will, dovetails with what is sort of a common moral fabric of the Abrahamic religions. And so maybe that's a good segue now into the immigrant community. So let's jump over to the 14th Street Mosque. If you've been over to IKEA and looked out the cafeteria, you see the dome and the minaret. And if you're ever around that area, there's a community called Al-Farouq Masjid. Al-Farouq Masjid is a staple also here in the city. And these two institutions are really the oldest institutions, Muslim institutions of the city. The Atlanta Masjid, of course, is much older, or at least the presence of that community is much older. But about 25, 30 years ago, a group of students around at Georgia Tech and in affiliated schools, mostly Arab background from the Levantina area, so Syrian, Lebanese, some Palestinians, decided to create a little Sunday school for their children. Many of them had come through the Muslim student associations at their universities. They graduated. Now they got jobs. They didn't go back. They're here in the 1970s after the 1965 Immigration Reform Act. The Immigration Reform Act in 1965 opened the gates really to the sort of third world to invite so many immigrants in. Prior to that, the American Muslim experience had been kind of trickles here or there from different countries, but really, really nothing substantial or sustainable. Maybe one community out in Iowa or something like that, but these were largely ethnic communities and their experiences don't differ much from the traditional immigrant experience in the United States. However, in the 1970s, after that Immigration Reform Act, you have a number of people, my father would be one of them included, who were able now to come to the United States and study. And so the real entry point for a lot of Muslim immigrants that you might meet, especially ones that establish these organizations around the country, they came in as college students, and they came in from as professional classes. You're talking mostly engineering, medicine, a few lawyers here or there. But, you know, if you come from an immigrant background, you better not show your face to your father if you're a young man, unless you're trying to be a doctor. Okay? All right. You better try to be a doctor. And if you can't pull that off, then you can be an engineer. That's fine. Okay, but you got to try to be a doctor. And if Yeah, really, you don't want to really go into business unless you're Palestinian or Lebanese, and it's kind of in your blood to do that. You wouldn't do anything else. But you definitely don't go into religious studies. All right. And you definitely don't do anything anything else. Go ahead.
Were any of the people who came to study, like in the 60s, 70s, women? Or was it mostly men?
Mostly men. Mostly men. But that has changed drastically in the last 20 years or so. And so, basically, you have a group of students at different parts of the country, and they form what's called the Muslim Student Association. The Muslim Student Association quickly sort of develops through family networks and sort of country, you know, old country networks across the United States. So we start getting the beginnings of a kind of a Muslim American organization that can spread across different campuses, and they might have annual conferences and get-togethers. Well, now they graduate, and then a second class graduates, and they're still in touch. Now they're having children a little bit later, and those children need to get married by the 80s and 90s, and so this seems to be a pretty good conduit to start getting folks to meet each other, and we want our children to meet one another, so hopefully we can kind of push along marriages. A lot of folks think about Muslims and marriage in terms of arranged marriage. You constantly hear about arranged marriages and whatnot. But it's really much more like peer pressure from all sides of your family. You know what I mean? And so, it is definitely a little bit more intense than what we might find in the normal social setting. But it's sort of you're expected to marry within your sort of immediate ethnic Muslim community. And if you're going to break from that, well, then you should be marrying within, you know, the Muslim community in general. And so they created organizations, not simply for the purpose of marriage, but I believe that the social dimension really helped further along these institutions. Now, in the 70s and 80s, you had these black Muslims, like the ones down in the West End, talking a whole lot of mean stuff to the American government and American sort of upper class society in the name of Islam. So what kind of position did that put these Muslims in? You know, now they become the spokespersons for their own community, and they start saying, no, Islam has no problems with America, blah blah blah, you know. And so we hear that line of rhetoric start forming in contradistinction to this one. So now we get the beginnings of an assimilation movement for the elite immigrant communities, and the beginnings of tension between the immigrants and the African American Muslims, right? Because they don't see eye to eye on how they should define Islam. So, if you go to Al Farouk Masjid today, the kind of line that you'll hear from the leaders and from the spokespersons is one that believes in an Abrahamic Americanism. They will literally talk about the Quran and the Constitution in the same line. All right. They believe firmly, and you'll find this in Muslim leaders around the country. Imam Abdul Rauf, for example, is a perfect exemplar of this. Imam Abdul Rauf was the imam behind the Park 51 Ground Zero Mosque in New York a couple of years ago. He wrote a book called What's Right with Islam is What's Right with America. All right. And it really just... You're going through the example of the Prophet Muhammad, through the principles of Islamic law, through an exegesis of the Quran, and lining it up exactly with sort of, visions of the founding fathers and major philosophical pieces of American identity. You find the exact same thing coming out then, of course, out of the Atlanta Masjid of Al-Islam, and in the current Congressman Keith Ellison, if anybody's familiar with Keith Ellison, out of Minnesota. He is an African-American Muslim, largely belonging to this sort of school of thought.
He was sworn in at Thomas Jefferson's Quran.
Exactly, exactly. So you find these sorts of connections. So I call that the Abrahamic American sort of immigrant model, and then we have the African American progressive, and we've talked about sort of the African American strident anti-assimilationist, and then we have what I would call the, well, what have I called them? I give all of these groups little names, you know. What is this one? Something reformism. Something reformism, but basically there are also a number of Muslims who have become more vocal, especially after 9/11, who are not comfortable with the traditional teachings of the religion as they are, or the traditional structures of the teachings and the institutions that are in place. And so I'd call them radical reformists of some sort. But these are not reformists in any other sense than the progressive, hard liberal reformists. So what you find is a rejection of traditional authority within the religion, and what they do is a direct reading of texts, direct exegesis, and they want to challenge things like patriarchy. They want to challenge gender segregation norms, regulations about the religion itself. And you often find these coming also out of the professional class of immigrant Muslim elites. And their aim is really to sort of create a more progressive kind of Islam. They're at odds with really the majority of the Muslim community, which by all accounts is a very... It would resemble sort of conservative Judaism, if that's familiar to anybody here. You know, that's sort of their style. It's conservative Judaism sort of style, I'd say, is the dominant Muslim American orientation. The one problem with this group, in terms of representation, is that they sort of speak with a louder microphone than they actually have. And so this happens because many of them don't have institutional homes. If you come into the mosque, for example, and you're a woman, and you want to pray in the men's section in the front row, you're not going to have many allies, you know, because most women who are going to the mosque don't even agree with the idea that they should be in that space or would want to be in that space. So it would, you know, so you find all kinds of little conflicts, you know, cropping up here and there, but they get an unequal amount of media representation in this country. And then they also occupy many powerful academic institutions. So at Emory, one of my great mentors and friends is a gentleman named Abdullahi An-Naim, and he is really representative of a worldwide trend here that has tried to reinterpret traditional Islamic texts and teachings and tried to make them more consistent with what might be seen like as Western liberalism or secular sort of democratic and social ideas. And clearly he doesn't believe that those are secular or Western exclusively. He just believes that they're human and sort of, you know, maybe divinely inspired in their origin in the first place. So for him, there's no real contradiction there. However, he occupies a space, and I say this, you know, I talk to him about this regularly. He occupies a space where he commandeers a number of sort of students and research projects. He can sort of garner a lot of media attention, but he's absolutely unknown to the rest of the Muslim community here in Atlanta. Right, only sort of people who are already kind of at the scholarly level or involved in these institutions would recognize him. We have a very sort of, let's say, homosexual rights-oriented agenda within that community as well. We have a women's rights agenda in that community. And again, these sort of occupy the same space, I think, as you would find those kind of progressive voices within communities of faith, both in Judaism and maybe, let's say, Reconstructionism, or in a number of different kind of Christian communities as well. So that's the last one. And then another strand that we have are what I would call the... I forget exactly what I call them, but these would be sort of the immigrant Muslims that came here in the 70s and 80s, not with the intention of assimilating, or maybe if they ended up living here, their hearts and minds were still attached to the old world in terms of politics and society, and their number one focus was really trying to use their presence in the American political and social arena to influence American foreign policy abroad. All right. The idea here was that I'm Palestinian, I have no home, I literally roam around the world on what they call al-wathiqa, which are travel papers. A lot of Palestinians don't actually have citizenship anywhere. So they ended up in a lot of Western countries because they got visas. That Palestinian community constituted sort of the intellectual and political hub of activist Muslim voices in the 70s. And so we have a number of figures like this. I'm sure many of you have heard of John Esposito out of Georgetown. He does a lot of work on Islam. He's the current president of the American Academy of Religion. That's right, isn't it? And so his mentor was a fellow named Ismail Faruqi, who taught at Temple University. And Ismail Faruqi was known to be sort of one of these sort of wants to use the American institution to bring attention to the plight of Palestinians and to what was perceived as an unjust and imbalanced approach to American foreign policy in the region. And so you have a political voice of Islam in the United States and in certain institutions as well. That has largely got, that was very popular in the 80s and the 90s, but clearly after 2001, it really it has really subsided, and really you can't really find it anywhere anymore. But it used to be quite normal to hear before 2001, you know, a very politically oriented sermon on a Friday afternoon or something like that. But you don't really hear that too much. And some of the voices within that movement clearly were a little bit more militant than other voices. And so, with right cause, the American government has really clamped down on those segments of that community, which has really shut down politics as a whole in the American Muslim voice. So that, so in the American Muslim public sphere, if you will, you never even find a kind of Amy Goodman approach or Free Speech TV approach to American policy or anything like that. You really have a kind of a mainstream sort of, I'd call it the CNN line to American foreign affairs. If anybody talks about politics, it's going to be in that sort of voice. The American Muslim community is really rattled right now with what's happened over the last decade or so, and especially over the last year, where we're finding so much about FBI surveillance programs and infiltration programs of the American Muslim community. It's quite disheartening, especially to those leaders who have engaged with the FBI in order to sort of do community building and whatnot. They found out now that the FBI was actively profiling those leaders and their families and their connections, and was sharing, you know, records across the country and things like this.
But some of it the New York police were doing, and the FBI was saying they were interfering with their efforts.
Well, yeah, so we have agencies competing to spy on Muslims. So then the last community that I would say is present is the, what I would call the homeland homesick. And basically these are the immigrant communities that are sort of freshly here, that have never really entered the wider American Muslim conversation or the American conversation, period. These are basically ethnic little enclaves that, if you go to their centers, they're giving the sermons in their native language. Their programming is usually centered around what would resemble kind of a cultural center, where they're trying to get kids together to play. They have, one of the first things that they do is language instruction, so that their kids are, you know, retaining language on the weekends. And Islam is sort of just there by default, so to speak. And we have a number of communities like that here in the city. We have subsects of the Shiites up in Gwinnett County. We have Bosnian communities in Lawrenceville. And at least one benefit of all that is that if you go to an American Muslim sort of grocery store, you can find a great array of food and breads and things like that from different communities, because now some of them are so established that they started producing their own, you know, food products for their own communities. So it's really quite nice if you know how to navigate and if you're into that sort of thing. So where do I fit into all of this? My father would fall into that category of American Muslims that came in the 1970s to study. He is from Iran, grew up in Tehran, the capital. His father is from a small village in central Iran. And with the rapid expansion and growth of the sort of American-backed Shah's government, Tehran was a, you know, bustling metropolis in the 60s. And so my grandfather was able, as an architect, to really tap into that. And so then my father was raised in a kind of a middle class, upper middle class society, you know, background for his social location in Tehran. Didn't want to stay, wanted to come to the United States. He says he grew up ditching middle school so he could watch Clint Eastwood movies. Okay. And so they had that sort of, you know, they had that kind of exposure. So my father's dream was to come to California and study, where he met my mother. And he met my mother, who's a Hispanic American born in New Mexico. And we are an interesting group. We call ourselves Chicano now, but to give us a name is pretty hard. My mother's birth certificate says Spanish, but our ancestors come as early as, well, as far as we can tell, sort of some of the earliest immigrants, actually Spanish conquistadors in the New World. So our community are basically pockets of villages in the mountains in northern New Mexico, which is sort of the beginning of the Rocky Mountains. And we speak a Spanish that Spanish historians and linguists have come to study because it resembles a Spanish, an older Spanish from, you know, 2-3 centuries ago. And my mother has green eyes, and we say the border crossed us, we didn't cross the border. And so it's a very sort of weird situation just amongst that group. But nonetheless, that background and being tapped into sort of a minority experience and identifying with Spanish-speaking communities growing up allowed me to understand American society both from an immigrant perspective, my name being Abbas Barzagar, I'm clearly marked as something foreign. However, you know, my father was the only one who ever came to the United States from his family. So my entire upbringing was, in my middle-class suburban sort of experiences growing up, and my family connections were with my Spanish-speaking family, you know. And so I saw America from a couple of different viewpoints growing up, both inside and outside. Both of my parents came from pretty intense religious backgrounds. My father was very secular-oriented when he came over here. The religious tradition in Iran is Shiite Islam, and Shiite Islam, in some of its ritual performances, can be very intense and involve the body in ways that resemble, let's say, Pentecostal practices, or folks are familiar with the penitente tradition in Catholicism, which is the self-flagellation, involving self-flagellation and things like that. So our family, coming from sort of a very rural traditional community in central Iran, that being my father's family, they're very religious, very traditional, and were involved in that. So my father, kind of being cosmopolitan and middle class growing up, wasn't really so attracted to that anymore. I mean, you can imagine if he's watching Clint Eastwood movies when he's 15 and he comes to Hollywood, he's not so interested in continuing that tradition. My mother actually came from, and traditionally, you know, those communities are Catholic, but her family was Pentecostal. And so she grew up in a very intense, also religious environment. So I think my parents both agreed that God exists, but we don't need to get so crazy about it. And so we grew up in a family where we literally had the sort of Lord's Prayer on one wall, and then a Quranic scripture on the on another wall. And my parents really paid no mind to organized religion in that sense. But somehow there was never a doubt in our family that God was active in our lives. And I'm trying to reconstruct how that actually happened. You know, we used to say grace at dinner every now and then. I mean, we did a stint of Sunday school, I think, for one summer. But I can't really explain how it happened, because it never happened in a ritualized way. But it was clearly communicated to all of the children that God is an active force in our life. Now, all of us went different ways. So we have, as you can imagine with that background, kind of a mix of outcomes as well amongst the children. But all of us are still very spiritually, you know, inclined. My older brother is a Tea Party evangelical. Okay. my younger sister is probably the least amongst us that's religiously or spiritually inclined. And my older sister is sort of a very active agnostic, I would say. You know what I mean? So very active in terms of seeking as many different approaches to the divine as possible. And I'm increasingly, now as I become a father and whatnot, very conservative, sort of Muslim. Not traditional, because I don't have a tradition to draw upon. I rely upon my wife for that. But very, very sort of orthodox, you could say, or conservative and whatnot. So I started practicing Islam when I was in college, and I started practicing as sort of a product of, you know, you're trying to figure out who you are in college and all kinds of things happening in college. But I was able to meet in my dormitory a group of foreign students from Uzbekistan, and those students would drag me to the mosque. Uzbekistanis, you know, their religion is by default Islam, but because of the Soviet presence in Uzbekistan for all those years, most of them are secularly inclined. So out of a group of about 15 of these students, one of them, his name was Iqbal, and I just wish I could be able to find him one day. He was the only one who was really sort of adamant about his religion. And so he would drag me to the mosque with him on Fridays every now and then for the Eid prayers, the major celebrations that we have, we would all go. And so I started, I basically started practicing Islam around my junior year in college, which was around the same time that I had decided I wanted to become a professor. Now, I thought I was going to go into political science and economics, but I realized the questions that were driving me were really about culture and religion. I cared about how societies moved and changed and how values influenced world affairs, and I just felt like political science could never capture that. Anthropology still got it wrong for me somehow. So I went into religious studies, and it's been a very unique path studying religion, both as an academic and studying in terms of personal growth and development. And I'm still on that sort of quest today. I'm going to Morocco next week for a dual-purpose trip to meet some elderly Sufi saints who happen to belong to a school of thought that I'm actively doing research on as well. You know what I mean? So there's sort of it's a very hard line to navigate, but it's what's brought me along. My wife is Palestinian, Syrian background, grew up in Kuwait, and her life story also resembles sort of this fragment of what happens out of world affairs and politics. Her father was expelled from Jaffa, in 1948, a major prominent, landowner, disenfranchised, moves to Kuwait, kind of rebuilds his life. Her own mother from Syria, also a product of sort of political events there. And so my wife was a foreign student in Boulder at the time, and the only way I was able to trick her into talking to me was to teach me, be my Arabic tutor. And so after a year of Arabic tutoring, I kind of revealed my intentions to marry her and whatnot. And so she never went back, and we have three beautiful children. And so we live up in Alpharetta. And my wife and our household is very, is very traditionally, conservative and culturally conservative, I would say. But my wife, if you look at her, you would just think she's a Spanish girl or an Italian girl or something. She's got curly hair and she doesn't wear the scarf or anything like that. However, the kids are, my little girl, she's 2 years old, she's already beginning to recite the Quran somehow. And the environment in our household is a very religious environment. But in a very sort of non-forced way. It feels very calm. If it was up to me, I wouldn't have been able to raise my family in that way. But my wife, having grown up in that kind of environment, knows how to teach a prayer before food, for example, or how to say something. I mean, my son the other day lost a Lego piece, and I hear him say, "Mommy, what's the prayer when you lose something?" And, I would never, it never have occurred to me, And so he's like 7 years old, and he's learning these things, And so one of the driving factors that keeps me researching what I research is to understand how religion sort of makes up your daily life and how your religious consciousness is developed at an early age and in your social settings that is never really attached to any kind of formal institution. Clearly we try to create that environment as much as we can for our children. We send our kids to my son, the 7-year-old, he's just finishing first grade now. He goes to the private school that's affiliated with the 14th Street Mosque that I was just describing. But we'll send him now next year, hopefully, to a charter school in Alpharetta that is run by Arabs and South Asians of Muslim background. And it really provides kind of a cultural environment. But not really. There's no religious teaching involved in that, obviously. And our 3-year-old goes to sort of a pre-K Muslim school up in Alpharetta. And so these are the kind of spaces that we try to create for our kids. And answering a lot, encountering a lot of new questions as we go along into parenthood, trying to think about things. But really, most importantly, just trying to raise the children with a healthy Muslim identity, if you will, knowing that they're, living and being raised in this country. So every year, questions of celebrating Halloween and Easter and, Christmas and those kind of things come up, as they do for most immigrant communities. And every community kind of deals with those a little differently, and every family does them a little differently. So our kids did Halloween this year, but not Easter. And last year, I think when we were staying with my folks in 2010 in Colorado, they did Easter but not Halloween. And so we're trying to figure things out as we go,
and then their candy intake.
We'll see what happens. But I want to make sure that we have enough time for some questions, and I know that you have service at 11, right? So I just want to throw it out there. You can ask me really just about anything you want, and feel free to ask me about my own life and my own experiences. I didn't know exactly what to share, so I'll just go ahead and leave that out. Go ahead.
I have a question. Your father, I'm not clear. He came to America because he did have a stable. I mean, it sounds like he was one of the ones benefiting from the life in Iran. Why did he come? You kind of laughingly said to watch Clint Eastwood.
Oh, no. Basically, you know, so he came to the States really just to study, and I think that in growing up middle class or upper middle class in Iran at that time, this was sort of the coolest thing that you could do, was to go abroad and study. This was a sign of sort of social mobility and whatnot. They benefited indirectly from the Shah's sort of economic expansions, but they were not part of that community of Iranians that was directly connected to the Shah's regime in such a way that they would have faced repercussions after the overthrow. Actually, in some ways, our family represents, I believe, a very large portion of Iranian society that benefited indirectly from the Shah's regime in terms of that initial middle class push, but then actually benefited even more from the revolution, in that the social conditions were changed and institutional conditions were changed to allow for these traditional religious families to really enter into a kind of society in a way that wasn't allowed during the Shah's regime. So basically this means that I have a cousin who's 21 years old, and she's attending full scholarship, the top medical university in Tehran. And she wears what they call a chador, which is a full black veil, not over the face, but over the whole body. And I can tell you categorically that had the revolution not occurred, she would never even go to college. You know, just those institutions weren't allowed there. And so a lot of the changes that you see in the Muslim world that are taking place towards Islamic government are actually being pushed by and having the effect of bringing an entire population of traditionally oriented religious communities into, let's say, the 21st century or 20th century sort of institutions of learning and development and economics. And so there's all these sort of non-expected results of these changes.
But so the Shah was, I'm just
going
to follow up, the Shah was not, he was more secular? Is that
Yes, absolutely. The Shah was a secular nationalist
who
promoted Iranian nationalism at the expense of Islam. And it was really his confrontation, with the religious establishment that caused these turnovers. If anybody ever wants, there's these great documentaries on Al Jazeera. I can maybe send the links to you if you like, but about the revolution and about Khomeini and all those things. Go ahead.
I have two questions. One is, if the United States is so bad, what is the allure for everybody coming here? And secondly, the Muslim community talks about Al-Qaeda is, that's not us, but they don't seem to be trying to do anything about cleaning up their own acts, so to speak.
On the first point, I would say that most Muslims around the world have nothing but absolute respect for the West's system of meritocracy, professionalism, rule of law, what is believed to be sort of a very healthy democratic procedure. They believe in all of those things, and they also believe that those institutions are a product of American culture somehow. All right, they believe, or Western culture. They believe that there's something to be gained in that attitude. One of the exemplary reformists of the early 20th century out of Egypt, he studied in France, and he said, I went to the West and I saw Islam but no Muslims, and I came to the East and I saw Muslims but no Islam. Again, going back to that Abrahamic sort of fabric, that underlying sort of our democratic values in the world today is a common moral thread. What Muslims around the world categorically have a problem with is the abuse of American power and sort of an unequal distribution of power and an extraction of sort of, you know, the history of colonialism and things like that. And all the way from the moments of colonialism, you hear Muslim intellectuals and activists basically sort of naively saying that you know, if we just convince sort of these people that they're doing this wrong, they'll change and everything will be fine and we can get along fine. Right? There isn't the idea most Muslim people in the world that these two things are linked. That progress, technology, and education are actually linked to colonial expansion. Right? Most people don't make that connection, whereas I think most critiques of modernity and critics of sort of from the left would make that kind of critique. For that reason, Muslims have always been drawn towards the West and not sort of the Soviet model. The people that have been drawn towards the socialist model have always been in the minority camp within the Muslim world. So it's really just about... there's really not a contradiction there. It's not that Americans are terrible or that the West is terrible. It's that they're doing something wrong and they need to be convinced otherwise, because everything else that they've got going on is great, and if they could just be convinced otherwise, then we can work together. And this is the attitude, for example, that enables such close cooperation between, let's say, the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries with the Americans and the British throughout the 20th century. On the second point of Al-Qaeda, I know that this is a common refrain. I hear it constantly, that the American Muslim community or Muslim communities in the world are not doing enough to counter sort of Al-Qaeda or extremist rhetoric and things like that. And I fully respect that many people may be under that impression. But I have to be very adamant in that nothing could be further from the truth. Because the first victims of Islamic extremism are Muslims themselves.
Sure.
Right. The absolute first ones. And so I would invite you to find any established Muslim leader in the world that has a website, that has students, that has a class or an institution that you can walk into. Okay? Meaning that they have a place like this, you can walk in and meet them. You can send them an email. You can call them. Anywhere in the world. And I would invite you to find me that person who has not made a categorical statement against Islamic violence, Islamic-inspired violence or Islamic-justified violence or terrorism or anything like that, and made that part of their religious agenda as a Muslim leader. I can tell you from all of these communities, even the hardline ones in the West End, African-American, anything like that, they have all... I have a website I can show you, a cache of fatwas that are written against Islamic extremism. And so... the extremism that is represented by the Taliban, by Al-Qaeda especially, is absolutely marginal. It's outlier. Meaning that you can't find anybody representative of those positions. You can't meet them anywhere. You know, if you were to meet them, you would report them, you would be in trouble, you would know that you're sort of in the wrong place. I mean, they're like a ghost amongst ourselves. You know, So I would invite anybody to really try to find me the contrary evidence, you know, which is mainline American Muslims or Western Muslims or even any established institutional Muslim supporting that kind of work. Okay. That said, there is a large camp, and I think it's a healthy voice to have, which criticizes American power. And there's really, I don't think anything... I push my Muslim community in America to assume that voice more actively, because it really shows you to be a loyal opposition within the American government or within American society is one of the best things you can do as a patriot. And so really, I invite my Muslim counterparts and positions of leadership not to try to kowtow towards American liberalism, but to assume an American identity. You have citizenships, your children are born here, they don't speak Arabic anymore, and they speak English. They're marrying different ethnicities, they're part of this society. So why not assume that role instead of constantly leaving yourself on the outside? So I'll be more than happy to back up everything I just said with evidence from organizations and institutions. I can send them to Vernon to pass on, because it's really an important point. There's a gentleman, a gentleman in the UK. He's based out of Canada, but he's very active in the UK as well. He wrote a 600-page fatwa against terrorism, based on Quran and prophetic precedent. Okay.
And explain to them what a fatwa is.
A fatwa, a lot of people think fatwa means a death sentence, but it just means a religious edict, you know. So a religious edict, a religious ruling, you know. So, but we find this constantly, you know. I just want to make sure we have other folks get a chance. Go ahead.
You mentioned that you wanted to have your children pass on our experience. I forgot what you called it. An ideal sort of Islamic experience. I want that with my own faith. So how would you define an ideal kind of life as an Islamic person?
You know, I'd have to say the first thing is an orientation towards... And I don't mean to be too abstract here, but towards the sensible and the beautiful. So growing up, even though I wasn't exposed to either of the religious traditions at all, somehow I knew that religion both made perfect sense and that it was beautiful. It was the good thing to do. And so we had, we just had these kind of feelings towards our religion. So for me, it's very important that the children be raised first and foremost with that orientation. And so my father, I remember once I asked him, I said, why do Muslim men wear beards, and why is it, why are Muslims supposed to have beards? And my father sort of answered a question about Islam for me like once every, you know, 6 months that I would ask or something like that. And it was just a quick, he said, well, the Prophet said you should do it and it's part of the religion. But if you think about it, the beard kind of protects you from the desert winds and the desert climate in Saudi Arabia, where Islam came from. And so it makes sense. And so really, that's one of the first things I remember about Islam. And so from that moment, I always knew that somehow there was this a reason behind everything. So to me, that was very important. I try to teach my children that there's a reason behind everything. I mean, he's learning, you know, the Prophet had multiple wives. And so for the teachers at Dar al-Nur, at his private school, they grew up in Saudi Arabia or they grew up in Syria. It's absolutely, you know, there's just no question. Okay, yeah, multiple wives is not a big deal. Everybody knows it. You know, there's nothing odd there. But you know, my son's kind of asking, why did he have more than one wife? So I have to explain sort of the context of polygamy and that history, but it's very important to me that he learned that. Then the other thing is that he has positive associations with it. And so this is, again, one of the goals of that ideal kind of religious upbringing, is that it's fun for him. That religion is fun and it feels good for him. So we sing songs together, you know, around dinner time when we're giving them snacks before they go to sleep. You know, we sing songs together. There's a kind of a whole, you know, a whole industry of Muslim music. And so I try to make sure that they have that and those positive associations constantly. When I take them to the mosque, I make sure I get them snacks and food and things like that. And I'm clearly, as an anthropologist, manipulating the environment to create a certain outcome. But I don't feel bad about it. I mean, any parent, any conscious parent would do that.
We appreciate your being here. It's time to go, but...
Okay, two more quick questions. Go ahead.
I just wanted to know if you thought there would be any settlement of disagreements between the Sunni and the Shiite groups, and what you thought the outcome in Iran would be. Ultimately, and if that's too long,
or in Iraq, you mean?
Iran.
Iraq.
No, not Iraq.
Oh, with the nuclear issue and all that sort of stuff.
Well, and the government.
Yeah, you know, I my dissertation is actually about Sunni Shiite stuff, and just to be honest with you, no, it won't be. But I can say
resolved. Is that what you said? Won't be?
Yeah, it won't be resolved because the difference. The existence of the difference makes up the core of the identity of each group.
Okay.
So you have to kind of kill yourself to accept the other in that sense. Do you know what I mean? In terms of your identity. Do you know what I mean? There's only a certain level in which one can do that. You know? And so that certain level, though, has a spectrum. And I would say that the majority of Muslim leaders on the Sunni and Shiite side opt for a pragmatic kind of approach to reconciliation. And so there are a number of ways in which people do this. So the official school, religious school in Egypt, has declared that Shiites are a legitimate branch of Islam, that they're just a different school of thought. And so most Egyptians on the street will recognize as such that as such. Of course, there are going to be people that dissent. In the Shiite world, there are people, and I can say this actually, the head of state, Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, has made a number of efforts to try to discourage practices amongst the Shiites that Sunnis find offensive. So basically, I didn't get into this, but imagine that there was a... imagine that there was an active Christian community that that said, you know, five of the disciples of Jesus were actually traitors. All right, but those disciples that you think are still really the you know, that you know your religion through, like Paul, or let's say that Paul, for example, was an absolute traitor, and that he did this and that. I mean, how would you even orient yourself towards that kind of community? So basically, you know, there's a pragmatic reconciliation, and I'd say that the powers that be have always tried to mitigate that, but there won't be any kind of resolution at all, you know.
One question here.
Sure. When I was in the Marine Corps, I was in a non-combat role, but we were all over the Middle East. We were Bahrain, UAE, Egypt, Oman, Kuwait, and it was really interesting. This is 1999, and we did it in 2000, and it was neat to finally see it, get out in front of the TV and be in.
Yeah,
it was amazing, fantastic actually. And we went to Turkey.
Okay.
And my uncle is a very, very conservative Christian. He goes to a very, very conservative church, and I have a hard time talking to him there. You know, Uncle Charles, most Muslims just want to go to work and come home and be left alone. They don't. They're not.
Yeah.
What you see on the news is not. You know, how do I? Where do I go to send him to see these so I can have visual proof? This is what I'm talking about.
Ordinary people.
Well, you know, the thing is that if somebody isn't inclined to see somebody as an ordinary person, it's pretty hard to convince them as such. There's a PBS documentary that you can find streaming online called "The Legacy of the Legacy of a Prophet," Muhammad, Legacy of a Prophet, which begins with a Irish firefighter who fought, who was one of the first respondents after the World Trade Center bombings. He's an Irish firefighter who converted to Islam before that. And it begins with him and it kind of threads through what the prophet means to people's lives and how his actions that day were informed by the prophetic example. And so what it tries to do is show American Muslim lives and Muslim lives around the world how they're religiously oriented and ethically oriented. And those kind of documentaries are actually very important because they give a personal face. You know, to people. But there's another one called "What a Billion Muslims Really Think." That one's a pretty good one too, and I could send you those links as well. You know.
I would request that you get that to Garden so I can send it to everybody.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I'll be happy to. Thank you all very much for your time. I don't want to keep you. I'll make sure I get your question. Thank you.